Episode 1587, My Strength is My Story with Antonia Malchik, A Walking Life.
Moms, needing a little inspiration and a ray of hope? You've come to the right place. This is the show that you can turn to for just the pick-me-up you need. This is Create Your Now, Your Best Selfie. Here's your host, certified life coach, personal trainer, and nutritionist, Christiane Wargo. Staring at a
stop sign, watching. Happy, happy day. Today is my favorite day of the week. It is My Strength is My Story series, and we have with us Antonia Malchik. Have you ever thought about reclaiming your health and your freedom one step at a time? We're diving into A Walking Life. For those of you who are brand new to Create Your Now, friends and family of Antonia's, welcome to our family. I'm so delighted of your presence. If you already even had the opportunity, you'll want to head on over to createyournow.com where you can learn more and sign up for the Kisses newsletter, the Keep It Simple Strategy, Everyday Solutions to Live, Love, and Impact. Well, Antonia and I had an incredible conversation, and I must say that this is not your typical book. This book that we talk about is A Walking Life, and she takes us on an exploration from childhood through really into adulthood and motherhood. The stories she tells and the revelations that she shares in regarding to walking is incredible. So I would encourage you to stay tuned, listen with an open ear, and who knows just what you might learn along the journey. So without further ado, let's welcome in Antonia Malchik, A Walking Life. Hello and welcome to Create Your Now. I'm so excited. We have a walker in the house, a woman with a master's degree, and she is on her way, an incredible journey. Her name is Antonia Malchik. She is a wife of 20 years and mom to two beautiful children, an 11-year-old boy and an 8-year-old girl. I bet it's a hopping house. She has written essays and articles in The Atlantic, The Washington Post, The Boston Globe, Orion, Good, High Country News, and many more. Previously, she was also a travel writer in Austria and Australia. I want her job. Now, Antonia is an author of her brand new book, A Walking Life, Reclaiming Our Health and Our Freedom One Step at a Time. Welcome, my friend. How are you?
I am really well. Thank you so much for having me on. This is really a pleasure.
Well, I am excited to have you on. I'm going to warn everybody, your name is spelled completely different than the way most people would pronounce it if they look at it. And I think it's beautiful. So I have to ask you, where does your name come from?
Oh, that's such a good question. You're right. It is pronounced differently from what most people would expect. At the time I was born, my mother's favorite book was My Antonia by Willa Cather. And that is what I'm named after. And it's this, you know, I'm a fifth generation Montanan, and My Antonia is an iconic Western book. And I've always really loved reading it. And so I do try to honor the pronunciation, although it is a tough one to get right. So I try not to be too picky about it. But that's where the name comes from.
Well, what a beautiful name. I mean, it really is, and so unique. And I just have to say, it's very unique, just like your book, A Walking Life. And I can't wait for us to dive into it. But first, I have to ask, what brings you joy?
Oh, I've been thinking about that question. There's my kids, obviously. They are a handful, but absolutely wonderful. And, you know, as a mother yourself, you know, every single day has its ups and its downs. But there are just those moments where you look at them and you're like, wow, these are incredible human beings. And also being from the Rocky Mountain West, I love being out in nature. I love going into the wilderness and camping and hiking. Being able to see the stars at night, and it's a big part of my life. So those two things in particular, family and nature together, really, really important to me. They're pretty central. So
that's beautiful. I mean, what can get any better than family and nature?
Right.
I mean, seriously, you know, you go out to the sky, and when you read in your book, you even talk about how you just love to get in the car and you just drive and you head for Glacier? Is it?
Glacier National Park.
There you go. Yes. That. and I love it. I just thought, and when I was reading that part, I was like, can I just get in the car too? We take so many things for granted when we walk outside. We just kind of do, and we forget to look up. We forget to look side to side. We forget to turn around and see the absolute exquisite beauty that we get to appreciate as human beings.
That's absolutely right. And I was actually away from Montana for 20 years. I lived overseas and I lived in the Northeast in Boston and upstate New York. And just beautiful places and wonderful cities. But coming home just filled me with gratitude, honestly, and being able to see the mountains every day. Well, the town I live in gets foggy in winter a lot, so I wouldn't say every day. But even that makes you more grateful, just having the trees. And like you said, being able to go up to Glacier National Park whenever I feel like it and be able to see the stars with no light pollution. It's an incredible thing. And it really just gets you in the practice of looking around and smelling the air and seeing what's there just freely available to appreciate and enjoy.
Well, speaking of how you went away for a little bit, what was it like for little Antonia growing up?
In Montana, I grew up in a small town called Belgrade. It's bigger now, but at the time it was, it still actually has these like dusty streets and old trees and old farmhouses. And we did not have a lot of money. I grew up on food stamps, but you didn't really need a lot in those days. We lived right downtown. So my dad walked me to my very first day of kindergarten, and that was it. I was on my own after that. And I could roam all over town. Just on my own. I've got two sisters. I'm the middle child. So I've got middle child syndrome. And we're all 5 years apart. And we grew up just hiking a lot and camping a lot. You know, if you don't have a lot of money, you do what's available and what's free. And we were lucky enough to live in a place where there is a lot of that. And we also skied, which at the time was very cheap. It was not like nowadays where it's a lot pricier. But
a lot pricier. Those resorts, They can really hit the pocketbook.
Definitely.
Well, when you were 14, you moved to Moscow. What was that transition like for you?
Oh, that was unreal, to be honest. I think it affected my life in a lot of ways that I still don't fully understand. My father is from the Soviet Union. He's from Leningrad. And my parents had been invited to help open a telecommunications business because my mother was a translator at the time. She's fluent in Russian. They just picked us up. My younger sister was 9 and I was 14. And they're like, here you go. New life for a little while. You know, it was still the Soviet Union at the time. So it was very poor. There were grocery stores, but all they ever had was bread, maybe some milk and a Fanta. For some reason, there was Fanta, you know, that orange soft drink. It was everywhere. It was really weird. And we would take 5 days a week. We had intensive Russian lessons in the morning, just the two of us. And then we would just roam Moscow by ourselves until our parents got done with work. But we also got to meet my father's family for the first time because he lived in exile. And it was quite an amazing experience. I hadn't met my grandmother before, and she died a couple of years later after we moved back to Montana. But I was so grateful to have even be able to have met her. She was a pretty strong, incredible person. So she's an inspiration to me.
Well, how precious for a little girl to meet her grandmother, not being able to grow up with her, but especially on that side of the family. That connection, because your father, like you said, grew up in the Soviet Union. When you were done with your Russian lessons, you all went out exploring, almost like walking explorations. Mm-hmm. What was that like for you to basically be walking in your father's footprints?
Well, that's a beautiful way to put it. You know, what was interesting was actually not the walking around after lessons, but when we went up to Leningrad, it's called St. Petersburg now, but it was still Leningrad at the time. And, you know, I'd spent my whole life in Montana and he lived in Montana. He didn't talk a whole lot about his childhood. I think his leaving his family was very painful. And, so it was hard, but when we went up there and we met his brother and his sister and my cousin and his mother, and he just walked us all over the city and he just filled us with stories, you know, about his time in school and he worked in a factory and about his parents. I'm sure that lots of people experience this with their parents, no matter what you're doing, but it does open up this whole other dimension of this person you've loved your whole life as their own human being. you know, he clearly had this whole life that I knew nothing about. And that was, it was fascinating. And it really stuck with me to be able to walk the routes that he had walked, you know, as a kid. And he used to go to the zoo to feed the elephants, and where he walked to school, and, you know, where he walked when he met my mother for the first time. They met when she was on a student trip from during her PhD, I think, from the University of Washington. So he walked with us there. And so we kind of got more of that story. And it was pretty powerful and beautiful.
Well, such a beautiful mystery, you know, kind of opened up. And with that, I'm sure your father shared some things with you. What did you learn about your dad that really had a deeper impression for you personally, not just because it happened to dad?
Oh, gosh, that's an amazing question. more for me personally. I mean, there was a lot about just getting to know him as a person. In later years, my older sister and I actually interviewed him about his life and just wanted to record it, which I recommend to everybody. And we just learned about, you know, he wasn't the guy we thought he was. He was a flirt. You know, he liked pretty girls. No, he did much, but he liked to flirt a lot. And he wasn't a rebel of any kind. He was a kid when Stalin died. So it was a very strict country politically and socially. But he would wander all over Leningrad with his best friend, and they would talk about art and music. And it gave me an appreciation for art, which I had never had before. I'd never really followed art in particular in artistic movements, which he was really, really into. And I had no idea about that. But what really stuck with me was the feeling of freedom that he and his friends had when they wandered the city. And they were not free under Stalin, and they weren't really free after Stalin died. But they could wander the streets and they could talk about anything. And you couldn't do that in many places. You couldn't, you know, maybe in the privacy of your own home if you really trusted your family, but you couldn't do it at work. You couldn't do it on public transportation. But they could walk over all over the city and feel free to really talk and trust each other. And that came back to me when I was living in upstate New York. And I had these two little kids, especially when I was pregnant with my second one and my son was 2.5 and I was 5 months pregnant. We had this huge snowstorm and my husband was out of town and I was trapped in the house because we lived in this like rural house with this long driveway that, and all the plows had broken down because it was this wet, heavy snow that they couldn't move. And I was like, and I started to really look at how dependent we were on the car. And I was like, wait, gosh, I can't walk anywhere with my kids, but my dad could walk a lot of places, even when he was living under Stalin. And, you know, it's not a true comparison, but it was really interesting contrast to think about, just as far as freedom goes and freedom of movement and thought.
Wow, that is fascinating. Because when I was reading your book, which you all are going to want to pick up your own copy of, A Walking Life, Reclaiming Our Health and Our Freedom One Step at a Time. When I was reading your book, it fascinated me because, of course, you know, when you grow up in one area, because he came over, he is an American citizen, but then to go back with his family and take his children looking completely different than what it left, I can see how you would see those contrasts would be even that more visible in a weird way. Sometimes mm-hmm. I think we can see contrast, but it doesn't jump out at us. And so what a way to open up your eyes. So in your book, there's a lot of research. And if you are science-minded, people are going to eat it up. Now, if you're creative, you're going to enjoy it too. So it really works to both worlds. I enjoyed the book completely. I read it. But you share some studies. You share some authors in there and their discoveries too. You also write about a public health epidemic. And that is loneliness. What role does walking play in loneliness?
Well, there is a lot of work in this area. There's a lot of research on loneliness itself. There is also a lot of research on how walking builds what's called social capital, which is basically neighborliness. You know, it's how people know one another. Like if then a disaster strikes, like people will help one another out. And that comes from social capital. I would say there's not a ton of research yet on that link between walking and loneliness, but it seems pretty clear that if you have a walkable community that really builds neighborliness, then it's harder to feel isolated and alone. And I think it's true of most of us that when we're going through a hard time, like if you lose your job or you're going through a divorce or the loss of a loved one, we all feel really lonely in those situations. We feel isolated. We feel like we're the only ones that are in pain. And when you have a walkable community where you see people all the time, like they don't have to be your best friends. They don't even have to be your family, but it builds a lot more depth of knowledge about one another and what people go through. And also there's some interesting stuff that I didn't put in the book about loneliness. Like there's a guy in Los Angeles who started a people walking business. And I think if I remember correctly, he originally started it as just like if you don't feel safe, for example, and you want someone to walk with you to a place and he charged like, I don't know, $7 an hour or something like that. But what he found was that people just wanted companionship. So he does get some people who want just a guide to walk with them through a park or something. But there are so many people who just want someone to talk with, just chat and small talk and connection. And the UK, Britain in particular, has done a ton of work in this area. The Old Age Commission has, or what's it called? They have a commission on loneliness. Like they have a whole part of the government that's devoted to helping people, elderly people partly, but also younger people. It's a big problem among teenagers. You know, partly they're just like, they don't have the physical capability to go meet their friends somewhere. So they're on social media a lot and that can increase feelings of loneliness. So, you know, walking with people, walking with friends, it helps you feel empowered. It helps you feel not alone. It helps you feel connected. And it's really that feeling of connection that I think a lot of us are missing in our lives and that walking can help bring back.
I completely agree with you because that connection, even though we are supposedly more connected like we are now, you're in a totally different state than I am. You're north, you're way north, and I'm way south. So we're a little bit split. But with technology, right, we can bring ourselves together. However, with us being so connected technologically, we are more disconnected when it comes to our social capital, as you would say.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I'm sure you're familiar with the work of Brené Brown, who's done so much work on vulnerability. In her most recent book, Braving the Wilderness, she talks about it a lot. And, you know, it's really scary. Like she quotes some statistics like air pollution increases your odds of dying early by 5%. Obesity increases it by 30%. But being lonely increases your odds of dying early by 45%. So it affects, you know, and they've studied this like epidemiologically, I think is the word maybe. but you know, it raises your stress levels and your blood pressure. There's been a lot of work in veterans with PTSD or just veterans who come back from Iraq and Afghanistan, and there are high rates of loneliness and disconnection, and their blood pressure, their heart health, and their cortisol, which is your stress levels, are really, really high. And so it does actually affect your body in very specific ways.
Well, speaking of Iraq and Afghanistan, up in Montana, you actually write in your book about two men. I believe it was in the chapter called Meander about these two young Marines that started the Montana Vet Program. Tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, it's an amazing thing. And talking about technology connection, I stumbled across it when I was still on Facebook. I'm not on there anymore, but it was just a random post that popped up. And I was like, Montana Vet Program, and they do hikes in the wilderness. That looks interesting. And so I got in touch with them, and it turned out that they live in Great Falls, which is where my grandmother lived for 40 years. It's very close to the ranch that my mom grew up on. And they're Marine snipers, both of them, and they did, I think, 6 and 8 tours, respectively. Yeah, it's a lot. And what they told me was that, and I'm sure a lot of people know this, but when they come back, when they're come back home, there's no reentry program. There's nothing to help you adapt from the intensity of that, the trauma and the connection. You know, there's a lot of brotherliness there and you have to walk away from it. And when they were coming back, they went to the Mountain Warfare Training Center in California. And it's a lot of wilderness work. So it's like tons of hiking and working in the woods. And they went on this huge long through hike with some friends of theirs. And when they came back, they were really inspired. It's like, we should do this all the time. Well, within the next year, I think it was, one of their best friends was killed in combat. And so the guy whose friend that was just kind of at a loss. Like he wanted to love nature and connect with nature and didn't know how to deal with this trauma. So he reconnected with the guy up in Great Falls, and they started this program to help. It was initially just Marines, but I think they've branched out now into other service members. And they do like 100-mile treks into the wilderness. And this is not a light thing. Like I've been back there with my parents, and it is really hard. And you're dealing with grizzly bears and mountain lions and worry about that. And like, yeah, I know. I can manage grizzly bears, but mountain lions actually really freak me out. But the unique thing about them, there are other programs like this, you know, that take vets kayaking in Idaho or on hikes on the Appalachian Trail. But what's unique about this is that they carry the dog tags of every service member that's been killed in those two wars. And it's they call it a pig egg, and it's a 70-pound bag, and they take turns carrying it. And I went to one of their Montana. We have a lot of pint nights because we have a lot of breweries. A lot of their members presented on it, and they just talked about how the walking and the weight of that bag helped them deal with grief and shame in a way. I'm not even sure shame is the right word, but guilt, you know, about having survived when so many of their friends didn't. They're incredible guys. My older sister was in the Army Reserve, so I obviously have a lot of respect for that. I'm blown away by how hard these two guys work and what they're trying to do for people to really bring them back to health and self-respect.
And what a beautiful story in that, because when you think about it, they're walking and yep. They're using something that we take for granted. We put our 2 feet on the floor and we just get up. For most of us who are blessed with our 2 feet, some obviously circumstances do not. So it leads them either to, you know, in a wheelchair, crutches, whatever they need, prosthetics, to mobilize themselves. When I read that in your book, I too am a military brat. And so I'm Army and Navy. And so, of course, anything like that, it's immediate family. And so I grabbed on to that. And so we'll definitely make sure we have that information in the show notes for those people who want to, you know, possibly help support the Montana Vet Program. And thank you so much for putting that, Antonia, into your book. Because like you said, we think people know, but honestly, I don't think people do really know. And you writing this book, coming from a totally different perspective than what most people are, in something that we take for granted, taking one step at a time.
Mm-hmm. Especially with such a powerful experience of grief and guilt, you know, just being able to take a step. Sometimes it's all you can do, but sometimes it's all you need to do, at least initially.
Yes. I totally agree with you. Yes, because the PTSD is very real. And when they come back, we talk about loneliness. They're beyond the loneliness portion of it. They feel isolated and entrapped in what they left. And that's a lot to get over. And we don't salute our troops and support them enough. So thank you for that. I really do appreciate that. In your chapter titled Quest, and I love your chapter titles, they're all basically movement type. I think wasn't there a toddle in there and a march? So this one is Quest. And you write, and I quote, "I took up walking years ago as an international goal when I was stuck in my completely unwalkable upstate New York community and struggling with debilitating chronic pain. At that time, when my children were small and intense and the days felt impossibly long and emotionally charged, I began walking out of the dual desperation of early motherhood and chronic back pain. What has walking given you?"
Oh, it has given me so much. And I will say that a lot of that is since I moved back to my hometown in Montana, which is Whitefish. It's where I went to high school. And I intentionally moved like right at the edge of town so we can walk everywhere. I am sure that you and many of your listeners remember what those early days with little children is like. And exactly. I got one of my nieces is like she was the easiest baby ever. And I just kept telling my sister it was so unfair. You have no idea. But my kids were intense and I'm sure they probably got it from me or someone else in my family. But I just remember that experience of, you know, there's a tantrum coming on. I'm about to lose it with everything. And we just step outside and, you know, like 2-year-olds do not walk very fast anyway. So we're like wandering around our little field and there's a little stream that runs through it and it's so slow. And this was before I had a smartphone, I think it was like right when they started. So I couldn't distract myself. And I just felt like all of our emotions just had more space and they could like wave away with the air and the sound of the trees. And I still feel that a lot. I will kick my kids outside if they, you know, if I feel like there's something about to erupt or me. everyone comes back feeling a little bit better. And the chronic pain, it's still there. I broke my bottom of my spine when I was little. And I was in several car crashes as a teenager. And so I just live with that. But being able to walk places instead of having to drive really helps. So just on a really basic level. But also, and this isn't uncommon, I've dealt with bouts of depression. And when I was living in that isolated house, I really didn't know what to do with it. Like sometimes I'd reach out to friends or my sisters, but it was just kind of steady, always there. Now, if I feel it coming on, you know, it's like feeling a cold coming on and you start with the orange juice or the zinc or whatever it is that you happen to use. I force myself to just go walk to the mailbox, which is like 3 minutes away probably. And I will usually end up walking longer than that. And it feels like depression is this thing that kind of gels inside of you and walking forces it to move a little bit. And I don't know if that's everybody's experience, but that's definitely my experience. And it's just, you know, it brings it back to that joy of being outside too. And just, my kids and I walk her back to school most days. I will say living in Montana, we had like 6 weeks of 40 below wind chill factor and we were not walking to school, which is more about the frostbite factor. It was, really awful.
Very awful. And you guys had a long winter this year too.
We did. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm glad you're probably more glad than I am that you're seeing buds and spring around the corner.
I am. I love winter, but that kind of wind chill is pretty difficult to cope with.
Yeah, it's very, very brutal. Yeah. Well, in your book, you also write about your daughter. She's the youngest of the two of your children. And you write about her saying, speaking about when she was refusing to walk at the age of 20 months. Nobody could tell you why. How did this shape your life, especially a walking life?
Oh, gosh, you're full of good questions. You really, you know how to do it. My son had been born premature. So they were both in the early intervention program. He was for other reasons to do with prematurity. And she was just because she just wouldn't walk. So that actually got me really interested in the scientific side of it because, what's the walking therapist called? Not the occupational therapist, but the gross motor skills therapist, blanking on what they're called, but, was also her therapist. And she would talk to me about this field we had out front. And it was like, you know, totally unkempt, overgrown with cattails and swamp grasses, and was really uneven. And she talked about how good this was for them and how she saw a lot of kids in much less privileged circumstances who like never left the apartment. She kind of referenced some research about how like walking and walking on uneven surfaces in particular has to do with your brain development as a child. And just the complexity of it really came home to me. And then they went to this sort of outdoor nature school for preschool. And one of the people there had told us one year, you know, the parents, that they'd had a group up from New York City, and they just had this slightly sloping lawn out front. Like it was a 100-acre property. It's really beautiful. But this place around the building was just a small little hill. And so many of the kids from the city couldn't walk on it, really. Like it would, they weren't stable. And I did talk to Karen Adolph, who's researches infant walking in at NYU, who's talked about in the book. And actually, I talked about her a lot more initially, but my editor was like, it's not a book about her. But she's a really fascinating person. And she said she didn't really see how that was possible for them not to be able to walk on the hills. But I went back to the people and they said it was, you know, it was really hard for them. Like they could not go out into the 100 acres and do stuff. So that really got me interested in the science side. Just like what it is that your brain and your body are doing. Like most of us learn to walk eventually. So how is it that that happens? And the complexity of it is stunning. It really fascinates me.
Well, it is fascinating. And I mean, all the information in your book is like, whoa. And it's cool because you take us back, like back before millions of years ago, back. And then you bring us to where we are now and where we are headed. What benefits can be gained or inherited by choosing and living a walking life?
All sorts of benefits. Brain health is a big one. There's been a number of studies now on Alzheimer's and dementia, and you know, people in their 70s who walk, 30 minutes, 5 days a week, have a much reduced risk of Alzheimer's and dementia. And there are other factors in there, like your exposure to air pollution and things. But overall, it does seem to be really good for that. It's really good for children's brain development. How children, as you know, you've read the books, so I won't go into this, but how children learn to read and do things like math is actually associated with how they learn to move their bodies through the world, which I did not know. And again, I find it really fascinating.
Your homeschoolers will want to chime in on that part, you know, to read up on that, because it truly fascinating isn't even a word. It just really gets you, you know, thinking, and you want to go deeper with it, going, gosh, you kind of take this stuff again for granted, but there's so much to it. So I'm sorry, I had to interject that because I know we've got homeschooling moms that listen.
And I did homeschool for 2 years. So I'm fully on board with that. I knew that they were getting a lot of benefit from playing with Legos and being outside and doing all sorts of fun stuff. Yeah, there's heart health. Cardiovascular health is really linked with doing mild aerobic activity like walking. It doesn't have to be fast walking. And there's a lot of things that have to do with just pushing your body against gravity, even a little bit every day. Like it doesn't have to be a hardcore, I don't know, Les Mills class or weightlifting or anything. But your heart, your circulation. The one interesting thing I found is that exercise isn't really related to obesity, which surprised me. But I did talk with a researcher who does a lot of work in that area, and he's like, he said walking is really crucial for things like cardiovascular health, mental health, and just kind of keeping your muscles moving, your joints, all sorts of things. But it's not a factor in obesity. That's much more related to diet. So that kind of, I was like, oh, I can't just eat that. We have a great ice cream shop in town. And I was like, I walk like miles and miles. I can't just have all the ice cream. I said, no, you can't. You can have it sometimes.
Darn, you want that extra ice cream. So do I. For me, it's root beer floats. That's my downfall.
I love root beer floats.
Yeah, especially the homemade ones, you know, with the homemade ice cream and the homemade root beer. Oh my goodness. Okay, we'll just have to have that another episode because those are so yummy. Well, y'all are going to want to pick up your own copy of A Walking Life, Reclaiming Our Health and Our Freedom One Step at a Time. Well, I was fascinated when I was reading your book because you wrote about Rebecca Gregory. And she is a friend of ours here at Create Your Now. We had her on, and we actually did an interview with her. And so we followed her story when her book came out. And so when I was reading in there, I was like, oh, yes, we know Rebecca and her story. What did her story do for you personally? What did it teach you?
Twofold things. One is, you know, obviously just her tenacity and her strength and her courage and her honesty. You know, when she said, I'm kind of done with all these surgeries and the pain, and I am ready to just go for a prosthetic. I think that kind of clarity in the way that you're thinking about your own body is actually quite rare. So just all of that together, you know, with her courage. And then I have two people in my family who are in wheelchairs. And so that's why disability is such a big part of the book. Well, that's what started me on it. And so I loved her story because of her honesty about it, because, I mean, at some of the conferences I go to and things, it's very like you're not allowed to talk about disability in a way that says, I'm not really happy with the way this is working out for me, like not being able to walk. And I didn't want to make that into a, gosh, you're lesser person and your brain's not going to develop if you can't walk. That's absurd, obviously. And so just looking at all the different ways that we can move through the world as a human being. And she, her story really started me on that. Well, it was really my mother-in-law, who was born with a rare form of arthritis, and her desire to walk, in which she does now, but you know, it's been back and forth. And just knowing that that opens up like, hey, this is a real desire and it can look really different depending on who we are and what our mobility is. And I just loved how upfront she was about all of that and what it meant to her life. I think she said, I'm glad you had her. I'm going to have to look up that episode. She's an incredible person.
She is incredible. She's got a heart of gold. Her story, it's amazing. And for those people who are listening, if you haven't listened to Rebecca Gregory's story, we'll be sure to include that in the show notes for you. Well, you mentioned about how this journey, A Walking Life, began. Can you go a little bit deeper into the story as to, you know, you talked about your daughter, but it really started out with your mother-in-law.
Yeah, well, kind of the two of them together. I just remember, like, this is another story that wasn't in the book, but she had her first hip replacement when she was in her 30s. So my husband's an only child. She was only able to have one kid just because her joints could not take it. And then before we had kids, she had each of her ankles replaced. And before that, she was having a lot of trouble walking. The second one took a lot of recovery time. And then my husband's English. So I've spent a lot of time over there. And my in-laws love Scotland. It's like they're just, that's where their heart is Scotland. So the four of us went up to one of the Hebridean Islands, and we were walking along this most beautiful path, and it's along this cliff with no fences. By the way, I'm not good with heights, so that was not fun, but it was just like you could see Northern Ireland just barely in the distance, and she was just so fulfilled. I mean, she loves nature. She just loves birds and everything about it. And just seeing how free she felt being able to walk that path now that she had had her second ankle replacement. And so again, you know, it goes back to that freedom. Like, this is what walking has gifted us, is this freedom to live our lives in so many ways. So the whole story of it kind of came together through those threads, through my dad's story of walking in Leningrad and being able to talk with his friends and be free, of my mother-in-law. And I also have a cousin in Russia who has multiple sclerosis, and so she's in a wheelchair. And then the kids, how they develop walking and how it's difficult or it's easy. And then realizing how constricted I was in my own life, having to be dependent on a car in this place in upstate New York. And so those all sort of came together, and I had written a couple of essays about that. One of them was called The End of Walking, which was the original title of the book, and we decided way too depressing. And also it's not. It's our future is really wide open, I think, in that respect. So that those things set me on that journey altogether. And I really wanted to see how they all fit in together. And the loneliness actually and connection was a surprise factor. I was not looking into that originally, but it kept coming up over and over. It would come up in the work I was doing, especially about community. I write a lot about community because I think community is very important. And so that's
awesome. Well, and I have to ask this question, and maybe it's too basic, but are there communities around right now within the United States that are, you know, trying to reactivate, revive, so to speak, the whole idea of walking life? I know in our area, we have a community that you can go and live there at the apartment, and they have everything there. They've got the grocery store, the doctor, the dentist, the post office. I mean, everything is self-contained, that if you didn't want to, you wouldn't have to drive.
That's awesome. I like that. Well, my town is very proactive in that respect, but not everybody wants to move to Northwest Montana with 40 below wind chill. I write about Denver in the book because Denver is also extremely proactive in this area. They've been doing a ton of work on walkability and public transportation. And Seattle's been doing a lot of work. And if you go to the website americawalks.org, and you can go like state by state and see if there is either a walking group, like people who walk together, or an advocacy group for walkability. And it's incredible how many of them there are. And some are more active than others. But like in the Southeast, there's quite a few. And I was really impressed with that. Like Wichita, Kansas also is a big one. The Twin Cities is really big. Obviously New York, but New York kind of starts out walkable, so it's not really fair. That's what I really wanted to talk about, something that wasn't New York. Everything's New York, and yes, it's walkable, but it's a big country. So yeah, I think there's a lot of different movements around the country. It is really hard because most of our infrastructure is built for cars, and so we're having to reverse engineer and rethink a lot of things. Like it's harder to work on a road that's like really narrow and just has two car lanes, and then you want to put in a sidewalk. It's like, how do you do that? But that's where you get into the nitty gritty stuff.
Yeah. It's important though to talk about that nitty gritty, because it is, you know, when, depending upon the community that you're in, I know I drive my son to high school right now because he's not driving, doesn't want to drive, which I'm okay with that. What child? I mean, he's a teen and he doesn't want to drive. Sign me up. Yes. Anyway, that's for a whole nother episode. But with that, on the road, it's only a 2-lane road. It's a country road and there are no sidewalks. And so when there are people out running early in the morning, and classes for the high school start at 7 o'clock in the morning for us. They don't have to like get there. It said, no, classes start at 7 o'clock. So they are up, going and moving. And I just pray every single time I see those runners or something, I'm like, do you not know the schedule here? You've got kids that do not know how to drive and you are running on this road. We don't think about it. And I think it's important that we start thinking about some of the basics. We go back to the foundation. And that foundation is a walking life.
That's a beautiful way to put it.
Well, you wrote the book. I didn't. I'm just saying. Well, what do you hope that they will gain from your book?
Well, I really hope they walk. That is an obvious one, but you asked about what it's brought to my own life, and I wish I could put into better words really what it's given me. It's just given me so much grounding and something to do when it feels like I don't know what to do. Like as a parent, like if I'm struggling, my kids are struggling in school or with a friend, and I really don't have the answers. And a walk doesn't give me the answer, but I feel like it gives me a direction. Or at least, you know, a way to just be there for them. And I really would love to see more people just take that on as a practice. I talk about the organization Girl Trek, which started because of the rates of African-American women who die of heart disease in this country is really high. And I didn't know that until I found their work. But that is what they've done. That's all they do. They get women to walk 30 minutes five times a week. And I have walked with two of their groups now, And they are incredible. And it does all of the stuff that you want. You know, it helps them do their health. They talk about nutrition while they're doing it. And they connect with one another. And then they get more involved in their communities. And it's kind of like the Montana Vet Program. It's like all the different things that walking can do for you. That's what they do. And so I really hope that people walk more. I had this idea of like a walking Wednesdays. Like, people did meatless Mondays for a while. And I was like, well, what if you just tried to walk everywhere one day a week? You know, and you realize how hard it is. Like you said, you drive your son to high school and there's no sidewalks. Well, what do you, like, you don't have any access to it. And so that's the second thing that I hope people take, is to bring walking into their lives and themselves into walking. And then to start noticing where it's not possible for them or for maybe other parts of your city or community. Because those are things we can all do something about. You know, we can all get involved in our communities. You know, we don't have to save the world all at once. We can just start going to city council meetings and saying, hey, we really need a sidewalk here, which is what people do in Denver a lot. They'll bug the counselors and say, look, this is by an elementary school. You need to do something about this. And they do, because, you know, moms have a lot of power.
Moms are strong, just saying. I love it. Well, that is, I think it's obvious, Jess, that you want to be, you know, you want your readers to have this walking life. But I know what stood out for me in reading the book was we take a lot for granted. I mentioned this before. And walking is one of those things. And it usually takes a tragedy, someone close to us, to realize that maybe I have something really good that I shouldn't be taking for granted. And that walking involves a lot. And you go into detail. That's why when I encourage people to pick up their own copy of A Walking Life, because you go into detail about how your foot and what happens. And I don't think people realize how much weight our foot holds, how it balances, what it does. And, you know, it's just something that we wake up, we just figure we're going to land on 2 feet and start going.
Right.
We don't always do that. I've had injuries to my legs. And when you can't get up and do that, you begin to think twice as to how you're treating not just your feet, but your body.
Yeah. And I think that's a big part of it. You know, as women in particular, but I've been finding men more and more also, you know, we're all so prone to abusing our bodies. You know, there's addictions, obviously abuse in that way, or just eating too much sugar, but just trying to control them so much. Like, ah, I hate my body. I want this to change and I need to control that. But when you start really appreciating what this body is capable of, and what it gives you, I think that's kind of incredible. You know, it does feel kind of miraculous. It's like, wow, this, I don't know how this happened, but it's amazing.
It is amazing.
More, you know, you can really start to feel that. It's great.
Yes, indeed. I agree. Well, you write in your book, and I quote you, "Faith is given to that which we can never in this life know for certain. Trust is given to that which has proven itself." How is walking an act of trust?
When I wrote that line, is it two lines or one line? I can't remember if it's a semicolon or not. I was thinking very much of the balance, because we're the only species that walks on two legs, and it's actually really precarious how we do it. Like you said, what the foot does when you're walking is quite surprising, actually. So that's what I was thinking of, that, like, you know, through evolution, we've developed this ability to balance on, you know, many times you're only balancing on a tiny little point, you know, as your foot rolls forward. But I do think that it extends out into, our communities and connecting with people, and with our own selves. You know, I think through walking, I read this book, I didn't quote it in there. It's called The Spirited Walker, and I can't remember the author's name. Carolyn Scott Kortge, K-O-R-T-G-E, I think it is. It's an older book, and it's about speed walking. I don't know if you remember the early 90s. It's like the speed walking was the thing. Yes. But her book is really spiritual, and she talks a lot about how she used to look at her body from the outside, about controlling it. And that when she started this walking practice, she connected with this deeper part of her inside and a knowledge of herself. And so I think that self-trust is really big. And I think it's something that, so many of us lack, you know, when you're, when you've got that self-talk going on in your head, that's a little toxic. You realize how little faith you put in your own self and your ability to make choices and see the future and do the right thing. All of that. So I really think trust in yourself is a huge part of it, as well as trust in your body.
I would agree. We've got, you know, that trust factor has to be there, and we have to learn. We have to be willing and open almost to embrace that part of us, because our bodies are, I mean, we are miraculous beings. And when you go and you start looking at it, I've had enough injuries. I used to run 7 to 11 miles a day. Talk about walking. I did it. I walked and read your book. That's how I got through it, because I walk and read. That's just my little trick. A lot of people can't walk and read, so I wouldn't recommend, if you can't walk and chew gum, maybe you shouldn't walk and read, but it works for me. In all of that, I really do think we need to open up our eyes to what, you know, what we have, a gift truly that we have. Well, I have to ask you this question, because I was reading your whole book, and I like to read the whole thing, like the acknowledgments and everything, but the last sentence that you write in your book, it reads this: leave a story in your footprints. What story, Antonia, do you want to leave in your footprints?
I tried to prepare for that question because I heard you ask so many other people, and I could not come up with an answer. I think that most of us carry a lot of stories inside of us. You know, I'm a mom. That's the biggest part of my life. I've been married for 20 years. I got married when I was 22, which these days is not that common. You know, I'm a daughter, and I love the wilderness, and I love nature and my family. And there's so many times when my life could have turned out very differently. You know, I could have not studied abroad and met my husband. My son's premature birth could have gone not in good ways. And I think we all carry a lot of stories. I realized when I was doing the last edits on it, I was like, I write about rivers a lot. I love rivers. They're fascinating and amazing. And I think that human beings are kind of like rivers. You know, we have a lot of tributaries that come in and go out, and they have seasons. You know, right now we're in the middle of spring floods, and that was all the snowmelt coming off and the river's high. And in August, the river will be very low and some of the creeks will dry up. And I think that a human story is a lot like a river. I think it changes throughout our lives and throughout the seasons, and sometimes it shifts path and we don't know why. But I think it's like you said, being able to look up and look out at every turn, it's that's how you can make the most of it and really find the joy within it. And follow your own story wherever it's going to take you.
Oh, that's beautiful. Well, I know people are going to want to connect with you, Antonia. Where can they find you?
I had a terrible Twitter habit for a while, so I'm no longer on Twitter. It's just not healthy for me. I am on Instagram, Antonia Walks, or Antonia Walks, but I mispronounce my own name all the time. And of course, you can email me. My email is on my website. you can write me a letter. My postal address is on my website. Yeah, I love to hear from people and hear about their experiences and the stories that people have to tell about the relationship with walking or with anything else in their lives. Or I'm always fascinated and interested and amazed at what people are capable of and what they see and what they bring into their lives. So yeah, feel free to reach out.
But we'll be sure to have all that information in the show notes so we can, you know, get in touch with you. It'll be easy. So if anybody's running or walking, speed walking, they don't have to memorize it yet. We'll just have all that information there for you later. Well, before I let you go, I have one last question. The series is called My Strength is My Story. What has your story gifted you?
I think joy and gratitude. I am grateful for the amount of gratitude that I feel every day, even when things are hard. Even stupid things, like my town just went through a very contentious school board election. And I'm sure lots of people have been through those. You know, it's everyone's at each other's throats. I'm like, why? We all care about kids. And to be able to wake up every morning and to hear the black-capped chickadees, which are the funniest birds, and the hummingbirds just came back, and, you know, winter was cold, but it was beautiful, and I know our summer will be lovely, and knowing my kids are growing and healthy, and I truly am grateful for being able to feel the gratitude. I think that being able to feel gratitude is actually a tremendous gift in itself. It's something that's really... Yeah, you know, thank you, Oprah and Brene Brown, for making a lot of us aware of what that brings to us. So I think being able to feel gratitude all the time helps me be strong. And my grandmothers were incredible people, and I aspire to be like them. They were, you know, ahead of their times and smart and strong, and they were incredibly honest. And it's something that guides me a lot in my life, that they lived, both of them, very different lives. My Russian grandmother in particular had a really hard life, but she never let go of her integrity and her loyalty to being honest, and her husband as well. So those things give me strength when I feel like I can't cope with something that's going on in the world or in my own life. I think, no, come on. You can do the hard thing. That's what I always tell my kids. You're stronger than you know.
Oh, amen to that. You are stronger than you know. And thank you for sharing your story with us and also including us in the journey of walking life.
Thank you so much, Christiane. This is a wonderful conversation. I am grateful for the opportunity to talk with you and with your audience.
Feeling inspired, ready to train for life and love your journey? Visit createyournow.com for more incredible resources to help you along the way. We'll see you next time on Create Your Now, Your Best Selfie. And remember, always be sure you consult your physician before beginning any health and fitness plan.